Hello and welcome to episode 134 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast about games on all sorts of platforms like the J. Cali JM6, which I have right over here. Maybe I'll talk about a little bit later. My name is Mark Uessa.
And my name is Daniel Winter. Hello, Mark.
How's it going, Daniel?
Good, good. We just got up to the Britannia Mining Museum today for the first time, which many listeners might recognize from like the X-Files and a lot of other TV shows. It's a quite famous sort of landmark in the Vancouver film industry.
I went there maybe 2 or 3 years ago. It's pretty fun. They've done, redid it a few years back. It's really nice. There's like this interactive kind of like light and sound show.
Yeah, it was quite well done. Mine. Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. And then there's that fun panning.
Gold, yeah, oh, my daughter loved that, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, little kids love
lots of pyrite.
Exactly. Cool, cool. Well, here we are, episode 134, and well into the new year. So we're going to, you know, reintroduce just lightly the format of the show. We talk about a quick couple of kind of news, maybe what's new to us going on in the industry, or just things that interest us. Then we're going to cover one or two games in the main segment. Then we'll do an off-topic topic in the dessert section. So, Daniel, do you have any stories that you want to start us off with?
Yeah, news is starting to heat up in the new year. I mean, I did want to quickly say up front, obviously, it's hard to take too seriously gaming news right now when we see so many other pieces of news happening in the world. And just wanted to say that our thoughts, obviously, with all the people of Minneapolis and all over the world right now are suffering under the various oppressive regimes. It's tough to sit here and talk about something as seemingly as frivolous as games, obviously. I mean, I want to tell myself that games matter exactly because they're frivolous and how we give meaning to the meaningless, I guess, perhaps. I'd be remiss to not at least mention everything else that's happening in the world right now.
Yeah, certainly. I feel exactly the same way. Obviously, it's a very unequal world and there's lots of scary things happening right now. But people have to live and they have to get through to the next day or the next weekend or the next week. And I think that entertainment, like games, like the movies and TV shows and books, and even music that we've been talking about lately, gives people like the emotional fuel to help them carry on. So I think that's something that we're passionate about. So we'll keep talking about them.
So I keep telling myself, at least. Quickly running through a couple of things. Something I thought might be of interest to you. I saw that Humble Bundle is offering a Call of Cthulhu bundle of PDFs of the tabletop role-playing books. Again, I've not played that, but I believe that was your number one game of 2025, of new games that you played in that year.
Yeah, that's right. Call of Cthulhu is an old system, but it's new to me. I think it's in its like seventh or eighth edition right now. I've never run the game, but I really like kind of the elegance of the D100, the percentile system really totally makes sense. A lot of details don't make sense, I think, in the rules either, but like I said, I haven't run the game myself. And I don't know if I would pick up that bundle for my own sake. I think it's like kind of nice to have like a game that other people will run for me. Horror is not really my jam, but like I do like to dabble in it as a player. So yeah, I think it's cool to have that game be a game I play, and I don't need to read any missions or anything like that.
Just having PDFs as a reference material, I guess, perhaps is always useful. I prefer the physical books myself. And again, I do remain a little cynical about the state of Humble Bundle and where exactly that money is going to. I see a lot of AI asset bundles on there still, but that's an option out there. Continuing on with tabletop games, I guess. Rascal News, the tabletop role-playing game sort of journalist website that we've mentioned many a times, has just announced a new spin-off podcast called The Rascal Reading Club, hosted by Thomas Manuel. Basically, they're going to be like reading through a TTRPG book and talking through that. I mean, so far, it's just Thomas. Their first episode is already out, and it's him talking about the Mothership Warden's Operation Manual. And, I mean, you and I played Mothership briefly last year. We did a one-shot around Halloween. We'd meant to talk about it and got a little bit distracted from that. Hoping to circle back to it at some point soon, but it's a good excuse to do so. It was a fascinating listen, talking through the philosophical game design behind that Warden's Manual and how it works However, it works as an introduction to people GMing for the first time, which a lot of these books don't go to that effort to do so.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'd like to talk about Mothership in more depth. You know, it's funny, it's a simple system, but there's so many meaty details about it, things that it does well. So yeah, I think we should dig our teeth into that sometime in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I'll drop the link to that podcast in the show notes and go and listen to that. And everyone talking about Mothership. There you go. One other bit of news I wanted to quickly mention, sticking with tabletop, is Leader Games announced that they're splitting up in a sense that Cole Worley and Kyle Ferren, who have long been associated with that publisher, splitting off to create their new studio, a board game studio that is, called Buried Giants. They're taking Arcs and Oath with them. Roots, I believe, is staying with Leader Games. I don't think they've announced anything of what they're working on next just yet, but you know, all of those games have been fascinating, if not enjoyable, personally. They are not necessarily, they're all acquired tastes, shall we say. I say with Roots sitting right behind me here. But I'm very excited to see what they make with it. They're always very innovative and creative from that team. So both sides of that team now, excited to see what they come up with.
Very cool. Yeah, maybe people know Root. I'm not a fan. But all of those Leader Games, previously Leader Games, are definitely interesting and thought-provoking designs.
Yes.
All right. Well, my appetizer stories are going to be more from a personal side, or at least maybe like the big bulk of game interactions I've had this past week have been knee-deep in Nintendo Switch repair, because our second Switch broke. Our first Switch broke in a different way. It wouldn't work on the dock. This is months ago. And then our second Switch just refused to start. So I suspected it was the battery. I ordered a replacement battery. They arrived. I spent much of Saturday replacing the battery, going on iFixit.com and finding just the right type of screwdriver I need to use. Of course, I had a handy-dandy electronics repair kit, so I had all the pieces. I still managed to strip a bunch of screws and frustrated with myself, but I managed to get the back panel off, replace the battery with the one I ordered from AliExpress, and the thing turned on. But I got this dreaded error 2102 or something like that, so I knew that this was something out of my control. Turns out that it was the error seemed to be with the charging port, which I wouldn't have known because the thing wouldn't even turn on. So it turns out it was the charging port rather than the battery. So I think actually my battery replacement exercise was successful. Nonetheless, I can't do anything with that error. It requires soldering, and I'm not that confident in my soldering skills. So my oldest kid and I ended up taking it down to a proper repair shop in town now, and we're awaiting their response. They charged about $140 Canadian, which is about what we wanted to spend. Even Nintendo is charging $100 out of warranty to do repairs about this sort of error. So, you know, it was about the same difference, and we didn't have to wait too long. So I will update folks on the saga of the various Nintendo Switches. You know, hot take, I don't think Nintendo hardware is that good. I think especially the Switch generation, pretty darn shoddy, especially the remotes. I don't think anyone can argue with me about the remotes.
The Joy-Cons, you mean? The Drift has been notorious. Yeah, I've got a pair that I guess I probably could put in for an official repair that I just haven't gotten around to it. But it's inevitably that they're all going to fail it sooner or later.
I've sent in 3 or 4 Switch Joy-Cons over the time, and I've bought some secondhand ones. Not secondhand ones, aftermarket ones. Do everything except for the IR or the whatever, the NFC, right? Which I don't care about.
No amiibos for you?
No games use that sort of feature. I don't care about amiibo. So yeah, so Nintendo hardware is not so great. We'll see how the Switch 2 generation runs. On the other side,
we have to see what issues may arise with the Switch 2 in the long run, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a young system yet. So far, so good, but we'll see how that goes.
You remain a braver man than I when it comes to repairing technology, or tinkering, shall we say.
Yeah, I opened up the PS Vita and replaced the battery there, and it went with flying colors, and it kind of built up my confidence. maybe older hardware is just a little bit more straightforward in its design. The Nintendo Switch is quite elaborate with its like multi-fold steps that you have to take. I don't have any problem digging into, you know, PS2 and 3 and 4 and replacing the hard drives. That's sort of fun for me. Comes from my PC building days. But yeah, it's fun. And these old devices, if I wasn't using them or they were busted anyway, what's the loss? They're out of warranty anyway.
One more bit of news, or a news trend, I guess, I wanted to discuss in the video game scene is that we've had a few stories this week. Ubisoft seems to be on the verge of a massive restructure, if not a total collapse, announced the cancellations of various projects and a sort of corporate restructure there. Capcom has recommitted to experimenting with AI along with various other AAA studios, including Ubisoft. And like, basically, I'm at the point where I don't know that I trust any of the AAA studios anymore. Between AI and all of the worker exploitations that we keep hearing reports of, it's I just don't know that I trust their disclosure or where that money is going right now. And not that I've ever been one to say that, you know, there's an inherent superiority to the indie scene, but at this point I'm largely going to be focusing on indie games. I think I don't know that I trust any AAA studio to give money to them right now. And I mean, what little money I have, I think I'll be making sure to give to smaller indie studios that deserve it a lot more.
Yeah, I'm in 100%, maybe 120% agreement with you about that. I think it was, to my embarrassment, maybe even just one or two episodes ago, where I was saying that Capcom was one of like the last bastions of AAA studios that were devs that were doing good things and generally being landing on the good side of history with fans and consumers, but not so anymore. This is a slap in the face to Capcom's long history of beautiful and creative artistry. They've always been amazing with mood, setting, especially character design. You know, AI art is just a slap in the face to all of that. So they don't have a leg to stand on with me anymore. And yeah, this just goes to show that there's a reason why people are flocking to retro game systems like the Retroids and the Ambernics, because good old game ROMs, you know, we don't have loot packs. The games, you just turn them on and they work. And we don't have the struggle of this constant exploitative online hype cycle and annualized releases. We just have good old games. So, yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you, buddy. I'm just wanting to play retro games and indie titles these days.
Yes, well, we do have an indie title, a new release that we've that both been playing that we'll perhaps be looking at a future episode. So we'll hope to coordinate on that a little more. Again, advocating and marketing for games is not necessarily our first priority. But in the sense that we're going to be talking about games, I want to be talking about games that I am proud to support and for listeners to go and support as well.
Yeah, that's right. We're here to support game creators, not shareholders.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah.
That's what it boils down to. Speaking of, shall we talk about the games that we've been enjoying?
Yes. Yeah. Do you want to kick us off today or shall I?
Yeah, definitely I can. All right. Speaking of good old games, I am playing a game that you can get these days that's published by Nintendo. Not the greatest player. Everyone says Nintendo is consumer friendly, but they're not always in my good books, let's just say. But anyways, it is generally good that they provide this good old game to play. The game I'm covering is called Just Fire Emblem for the Game Boy Advance, just to delineate there. This is the first one that was officially translated into English, but as I've discovered, it's not a remake of the original game. Apparently, this is the seventh entry in that series, which I think started way back in the 8-bit days, probably on the Famicom, but was only locked away in Japanese for the longest time. But this was way before the current days of mobile apps and waifu dating simulators of the Switch era Fire Emblem phenomenon.
Now, I did just see that they added a GameCube Fire Emblem to the Nintendo Online service. I don't recall the subtitle of that one.
Yeah, that one is called, confusingly, it's called Path of Radiance, not Pools That's of right. Radiance. Path of Radiance, Fire Emblem Path of Radiance. I think it's out already, and only for the Nintendo Switch 2 because it's a GameCube game. So,
right,
but you can only play the GameCube supported games on Nintendo Switch Online on Switch 2.
Now, is this Fire Emblem that you've been playing? Is that on Nintendo Online?
Yes, yes, that's okay. Right. And you can play Excellent. This one because it's for the GBA. You can play it on Nintendo Switch 1, Lite, OLED, Switch 2, what have you. I've been playing it on the TrimUI brick, Ooh. But I do subscribe to the service. So, of course, you can play it there. So, like I said, this game is confusingly titled. It's not the original. It's sometimes called Fire Emblem Blazing Blade. Which is not to be confused with The Binding Blade, which is also on the GBA.
Running out of
time
there.
Come on, guys. get the act together with your naming. Okay, this is a 2003 game originally, but you can play it on Switch, which is great if you subscribe to that service. And it's by longtime developer Intelligent Systems. Now, if I believe they do all of the Fire Emblem games from the beginning to now, so it's still in good hands. And other gamers from the GBA era might be familiar with that name for another strategy series that they produce called Advance Wars. Have you played either of those series, Daniel? Advance Wars or Fire Emblem?
The only Fire Emblem game I've played was Three Houses, I want to say. Mm. Well, maybe there was one prior to that, but that was the main one that I actually put some serious time into.
Yeah, the Nintendo Switch titles also have some confusing names as well. There's Three Houses, Three Hopes, and then I forget what that other one is called. But yeah, Intelligent Systems has helmed all of them, and personally, I have more experience with the Advance Wars series. Played Advance Wars, I think there was two... There was definitely one on the GBA, and there might have been at least two on the DS as well. I played a smattering of those. Generally, as you know, I like modern era, modern setting games, and I'll kind of be comparing them a little bit. But there is actually a considerable amount of overlap in them as well. Fire Emblem is very much a top-down 2D strategy, action strategy game like Advance Wars, but it involves fantasy characters, you're dealing with knights, people riding Pegasus mounts, and you're dealing with swords, spears, and pikes, and arrows, rather than artillery and cannon fire. But very much the same. And this particular entry, Fire Emblem for the GBA, carries over a lot of the kind of the hallmarks that you might associate with the Fire Emblem series. I assume that's a lot of these qualities came more recently, but I was interested to see that this game, over 24 years old at this point, 23 years old at this point, really had a lot of those elements baked in. Some of those standard qualities of a Fire Emblem game are a large cast. This one has that in droves. This has a large cast of, you know, attractively illustrated anime-style fantasy characters. They all have bright, colorful hairdos and various designs. They're not all spindly little waifs either. There's like skinny, pretty boys, and then there's kind of burly, like potato sack face dudes, as well as lithe women and little kid type characters come in there as well and throw stones. Also,
are these sort of pre-generated characters or are they randomized?
They are all pre-designed. But depending on how you play, you might not actually encounter all of them.
Okay.
So Fire Emblem's pretty interesting. So like Advance Wars, Fire Emblem starts you off on these maps. They're simple 2D maps. Mm. I think there isn't even any fog of war from what I recall. You can basically see everything that's going on in all corners of the map. It's actually a lot similar to Unicorn Overlord, which you and I played fairly recently. I think even Unicorn Overlord has some fog of war. But so far, in this game that I played a decent amount of, there's no fog of war in it yet. But throughout the map, there are, as you might expect, rivers, bridges, grassy fields, and mountains. But there's also villages and castles. And you can optionally visit those villages and castles. You don't have to achieve most objectives of the missions. But if you visit some of them, you will encounter characters who might agree to join your overall party. So I believe these are missable characters. So that's actually a really kind of cool aspect of this series, is that you find these recruitable characters. They're woven into the story lightly. The story is generally light, especially with when you're dealing with a large cast. And so it has that quality that's, you know, even some of the, like the Suikoden series, or like I mentioned, Unicorn Overlord also has, where you just kind of go over the map and you recruit like a whole literal army over the course of your gameplay. Yeah, so these are predefined characters, and they all kind of fall within these tropes, and they also fall within these kind of like military uses. So another aspect of Fire Emblem games is they use this rock, paper, scissors combat system. So if I'm understanding it correctly, it's basically swords versus spears versus axes, I think is the main is the main loop. And tertiary to that, there's arrows, and then there's long-ranged spells. But those don't work like the rock, paper, scissors system. They're just generally kind of secondary to it. Really, at the heart of it is your, is that trifecta there. And I always forget which is stronger than what. But that's at the core of it. It's not
particularly intuitive, is it? Yeah.
No. And in fact, I think some of the games even have like the little what is better than what printed in
the little reminder
screens. Which I think is always good. Like, they're not so distinct. Like, every weapon has a little icon that will tell you whether it's a sword and a spear. And if possible, I like to equip my characters with maybe like two out of the three. So then they could at least swap it out, depending on the type of enemy that they're up against.
Do you have much sense of what you're going to be up against when you start a mission?
Yeah, actually, it's not that bad. This game, like you would imagine with any game of sizable length, kind of starts small and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And as you play more and more, I'm in chapter like 15 or 16 of this game. And I don't know how many there are, but like I'm at least halfway through. Maybe there's 24 or something like that. There are like some of the maps are, you know, just like two GBA screens wide to start. And then the ones I'm in now are like eight GBA screens wide. So you have to do a lot of panning and scrolling all over. And some of them, your fighting force is generally about 8 to 10 units. Sometimes you're up against like 40 or 50 units. So, and also there are cases where they will spawn reinforcements over the course of the game unless you do something. There's other cases also where there's hidden rooms where you might find additional friends or foes or treasures. So it actually varies quite a bit. And you asked, how much do you know in advance? Well, just from seeing their 2D character sprites, you know roughly what type of enemies you're going to run into. But eventually they introduce, in this game anyway, a kind of a seer slash fortune teller character. And this woman, you can utilize, it's a choice. It's optional. And you have to pay her a little bit of your funds. Funds are quite easy to come by from what I've seen. But funds are useful for buying items, extra items or equipment, because items and equipment are all expendable in this game. Like, say, Legends of Zelda Breath of the Wild or something like that, a spear has a given number of uses, and once you've used them all up, like, you can have a fighter that's got no weapon. And that's not great. So yeah, you do have to save up your money to spend on that. But if you choose to, before a battle starts, you can pay the fortune teller to give you a preview of what types of enemies you might have to expect. And also even like other conditions like the weather or terrain. So that aspect of it is pretty cool. And then you asked, like, what sort of characters you come up with. I actually found that I don't think there is character selection. Like, basically, all of my characters that I have in my entourage are out there.
Is there any, like, commander avatar that you're playing as?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there is. There is a commander, and I believe in most cases, it's game over if you lose the commander.
Right.
Whatnot. But the commander is pretty, like, forgettable. They're not that amazing. Maybe they have, like, a slightly better sword than
they're usually
guys.
A bit of a cipher, really.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, I told you this game has a large cast. This game has large casts because there's a different protagonist in the first 12 missions than there are in the subsequent missions. And that different protagonist comes with different supporting characters. So there's actually like two large casts of characters that I've run into.
It's like two different campaigns, or is it like a continuation? Okay.
There are two different campaigns. So the first 12 missions I played is with this one character, a woman character. And she's interesting. She comes from this like smaller ethnic group, and her ethnic group is looked down upon. They're kind of like maybe modeled over like semi-nomadic tribes, like Mongol riders, nomadic tribes that have their own traditions and martial traditions and whatnot. And they're intermarrying with more like European coded types of characters. And there's like sort of like a war of succession. And that kind of arc has a start and a finish. And then chapter 13, it's a different protagonist, different supporting characters. You kind of like lose the characters that you were kind of relying upon, that you had equipped in certain ways. And you're being reintroduced to a new cast of characters. So it's pretty overwhelming how many characters that they throw at you. And maybe the splitting up of the campaigns was just a kind of reason to allow for more characters. It would kind of be confusing if it was one story and there are 40 characters, but if there's two stories and 20 each, maybe it's not so bad.
Well, a lot of real-time strategy games used to play with that, like your Warcraft or your what was the military one?
Command and Conquer.
Multiple campaigns that you're going through with different sets of characters, and you basically start from fresh each time.
Yeah, but most of those RTSs were filled with a bunch of nameless peons, though. This one, each of your units has a name and a personality and dialogue. So that's been always unique about this game system. And another point that most Fire Emblem games carry forward is that if you lose a character, they're permadead. Which is not for everyone. It's definitely not for me, but I respect it. I respect that choice.
Well, the other thing with Fire Emblem is that it tends to skew towards a fair bit of luck and like roll of the dice within each mission, within each attack, as opposed to some others that are more deterministic. And so it does lend itself towards safe scumming if you unexpectedly whiff and end up losing people.
Most certainly, especially with this presentation, which, like I told you, is on either my retro handheld or even on the Nintendo Switch online service, there are save states. So if you're using save states, which I wholeheartedly recommend, if you have limited time and a desire to play through some of these older games, use them, try stuff out, see how things go. There's no game save police. I don't care. save scum all you want. I'm doing it a lot. And as a result, this game is easy breezy, but not without challenge. And like a lot of games, if I fail, then I'll just restart from a previous save point. I just have more options of when I can put those save points in this one. But I respect that choice, that there is permadeath. And you were arguing about luck. Yeah, I think the combat rolls are based similar to D&D on an invisible die roll. Mm-hmm. Whereas I'm pretty sure that in Advanced Wars, it's not. Like if you're going a large tank against a medium tank or large tank against infantry, and depending on which terrain you're standing on and the opponent is standing on, those results are fixed.
Or like Final Fantasy Tactics, it'll tell you like exactly how much health this is going to shave off.
Oh, but Final Fantasy Tactics does have a hit randomness. You can, if you roll the dice wrong, you can miss.
Am I misremembering that? I forget. There's a scale usually as to how much determinism that goes into these games.
Yeah, for sure. Like, you might have like an 80% hit rate, so like you only lose on rolls of, you know, 81 plus or something like that. Anyways, this one does have that randomness built in. It's pretty mild. The combat resolutions are really quick. The animations are actually quite lovely. The characters, they're not as cinematic as the Advance War one is. I love the Advance Wars ones because they're like little cartoon vignettes. A little bit similar to maybe like Civilization Revolution. If you remember playing that one, Sid Meier's Civ Rev 1 and 2. This was like a 15-year-old game series or whatnot. But they had like a little movie taking place on half of the screen and the other half of the screen. And they split down the middle and you saw the conflict resolve either way. I really like that one. Not quite as slick as the modern interpretation of that in something like Unicorn Overlord. But you got this little animation flourish between the characters. It's fast, it's quick, but still there's some artistry there. I think it's good. It's just right, in my opinion. So I'm saying that this game hews a lot to a lot of the standards of Fire Emblem because it is kind of a standard Fire Emblem. This game like has a lot of characters. They are mildly charming, but the story is kind of like comically nonsensical and underwhelming. It's convoluted for convolutedness sake. It's kind of like Game of Thrones without any of the seriousness to it. Characters, you know, a dozen characters, side characters are introduced to instantly be killed off or betray you or something like that, just as you might expect. So nothing special going on there. I think the art of it is quite good in terms of the character designs, but there's a bit of a jarring contrast between the colorful primary colors of the character art and then the kind of the muddy washed out colors of the backgrounds. And it just doesn't feel unified to me in the same way that the art presentation of Advance Wars does. It's really strange because these are the same studios. Presumably they have access to the same artists involved, the same art directors, and these are both their bespoke series, so it's not like they have any like licenses that they have to keep up with. Just for some reason, this particular entry just doesn't seem as visually polished as some of their others. But that aside, it's very smooth to play. I'm really enjoying it. And like I said, I prefer Advance Wars, but I see why. This game shows me why Fire Emblem is generally more popular, because it literally has more character to it. You know, I'm not sending nameless peons or, you know, armored vehicle one versus heavy tank B. I'm sending, you know, this character or that character.
You get invested. In. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And there isn't any dating simulator aspects at all. So don't expect any of that. But there's plenty of story bits. There's like story everywhere. Before the mission, during the mission. Like I said, visit those villages. You're going to recruit new characters, hear story tidbits. It's a lot of fun to discover the little details in this game. And I think this won't be my last Fire Emblem game to dig into. I haven't dug into the Fire Emblems very seriously in the past, but I'm going to finish this one. I'm going to carry on and catch up to some of the Switch versions. Or maybe GameCube on Nintendo Switch Online.
Yeah. Lots of options on there. I still want to get to Tactics Ogre as well. It's the next game on my tactical backlog.
Yeah, Tactics Ogre. You mean like this series right here?
Very cool. I've got the Switch remaster to check out.
Yeah, the Tactics Ogre is a venerable series, and it predates Final Fantasy Tactics. I think it's the same director, if I'm not mistaken. But cool stuff. Yeah, that's all I have to say about Fire Emblem for the GBA. It's good. Solid. I would say 80%. Cool. Go play it.
Awesome. Well, I mean, I definitely have a lot more video games I could talk about. I wanted to talk a little bit more about tabletop, and that's been a little bit neglected on the podcast, shall we say. Partly because my board gaming friends have been sick. We just haven't been able to play games the last couple of weeks. My daughter still just wants to play the Pokemon TCG. Fair. I do have a role-playing game that I've been playing, Realms of Peril, which I've spoken a little bit about, and I hoped to rope you into that. That some scheduling unfortunately fell through recently, but we do want to discuss that in some detail at some point in the near future. So in light of that, I actually ended up reading through a new TTRPG book, a game I've not played, but just in the interest of seeing what's new out there on the RPG scene. This is a new zine, I guess, you can buy from itch.io called Worm. That's Worm with a Y, W-Y-R-M. This is designed by Spencer Campbell from Gila RPGs. And it's basically a rules light OSR, fantasy adventure, ostensibly, which is obviously a genre that we've both been interested in. You've spoken about Dungeon Classics. What's the name of that series?
Dungeon Crawl Classics. Dungeon Crawl Classics. And I've also played Old School Essentials at a con, I believe. Yeah.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And in Realms of Peril, which I've been playing, it definitely also fits into that. So I've been very curious about these sort of these elegant OSR innovations. And this is really only about 20 pages. I will say up front, this seems to be not quite an alpha, but it does seem to be like a first stab at what's going to be a much larger project. Spencer has said that they're going to be, you know, working on this over the course of the year, at least releasing a lot more content and rules. And there's a game jam happening right now for, you know, more adventures and ideas and modules. It's designed to be a very modular system. And so obviously reading through it, I've only got a very brief understanding without playing the game, but a few things did stand out to me that make this game special. One, in that everything basically is reduced to tiers. So character levels, that's a tier. Enemy levels, that's a tier. Weapons and armor, also tiers. Basically everything being tier 1, which equates to a D4, scaling up to tier 5, I think, which is a D12. If you have a tier 1 sword, you're going to be rolling a d4. If you have a tier 5 sword, you're going to be rolling a d12. So interestingly, like the higher your level, the more variance is going to be. But there's also, obviously at higher levels, you're going to have more tools available to you broadly as well. The crits, I believe, hit on like the highest of whatever die you're rolling. So crits are actually more likely at a lower levels, perhaps sort of evens out some difficulty at that lower levels as well. But I think there is overall some elegance to this system, obviously reducing everything down to the tier system. Like there's a lot less maths involved. You're always going to be rolling against, I think you're always trying to hit a 4 is the sort of the threshold, plus some like rolling against the enemy's tier level plus 4 as a threshold. So where some confusion might come in, I mean, this might be more intuitive at the table, but it's not always clear, like when the rules say tier, do you mean the tier score, like 1 to 5, or do you mean the tier dice? There's like, it's all because everything is using the tier. I think that could be cleared up a little bit, perhaps. I think the rules could use a little bit more polish in that regard. But it is interesting just in terms of not having a lot of rules overhead. You can just, everything can be reduced down to that simple scaling system.
Yeah, I actually know of Gila Studios. I own RPGs. I own about like 4 of his other titles, including, I think there's Nova, Lumen, Dusk, and Loot. The latter, Loot, of which I'm very interested to bring to your attention. Because it's quite board gamey, actually. It literally has to do with slots that you can fill with loot. And everything is just kind of like itemized. Like, so there's equipment slots. It's logical. It makes a lot of sense. And I think it would be a great lightweight RPG to play for maybe people that don't think that they're into tabletop RPGs. But anyways, I'm getting ahead of myself. Gila RPGs, they do good work.
Yeah, I hadn't actually made that connection, but I recall Loot now that you mention it. It is a struggle I found with a lot of these zine TTRPGs, where they do have an elegance to them, and a focus on rules, and just like a key set of rules that are defining the whole game. Coming from the board game scene, though, I often find those rules not to be completely fleshed out as I want them to be. Like, they like going on vibes a bit in some senses, that I need a little more clarity, personally. But the other thing being here, because this is so brief, it doesn't really give you a sense as to how you could run this game. It doesn't really tell you how to GM this game. It gives you a sample hex crawl, but doesn't explain how hex crawls work. Like, this isn't going to be my first hex crawl, essentially. You're going to need some other resources to guide you through that. But again, they're working on it. There's going to be more material released at some point.
Yeah, I was just thinking to myself that the real secret about RPGs is that these rule sets that come from these zines are, you know, sort of intended to be bolted upon skill sets and maybe even rules from other systems that you already know that you like, right? So if you don't like the combat in a game, you might be able to bolt on the combat of another RPG, but maintain the kind of the story building or the characters and the relationships that you enjoy from something like
Mothership.
Yeah, Mothership, or, you know, Blades in the Dark, right? You don't have to abandon the things you like from other games just because you don't like all aspects of the game. So really, is there a one best RPG out there? Probably not. And that's the reason why most people that get into this hobby like a variety of games. Some would argue that there's one be-all and end-all RPG, but maybe they just aren't trying hard enough.
Well, speaking of Blades in the Dark, that one actually did come to mind with the other mechanic that stands out here. You mentioned slots for loot, and this does have this sort of logistical sense of, well, you can carry 6 slots of items, but you don't actually like set out what items you're carrying in advance. You have treasure, or presumably you'll find treasure along the way, but you never actually like sell that treasure, get money, use that money to buy things. Basically, you spend treasure as a currency, which again is a very board gamey mechanic. But so treasure almost exists in this quantum state, and in the moment when you might need an axe or rope, you'll spend that treasure as a currency to call in this item, and that equipment can also exist on the tier scale. Obviously, like, your treasure is a tier that can buy a certain amount of things, but similar to Blades in the Dark, where in Blades in the Dark, you actually had a list of, here's all the equipment I'm potentially carrying, but I'm not committing to it taking up a slot until I need it and use it in the moment. And this is going at one step further. Like, you don't even have to have committed to like buying specific items. You can just decide, oh, you know, I think a ladder would be really helpful right here. I'm going to say this treasure is now a ladder. And I think it obviously is going to appeal to a lot of people who like creative solutions, improvising, like clever plays. Personally, it's probably going to be a little too open-ended. For me, I just use the hammer on everything, sensibly, right? Everything's a nail, I'm going to use the hammer. But I can see that appealing to a lot of people in being much more open-ended.
Yeah, from my experience, most RPG players will try and shoehorn their one skill to be able to do almost anything imaginable. Yeah. So there will always be some sort of person trying to take advantage, and then maybe some rules lawyer also sitting at the table trying to wrangle them under control. So it takes all kinds.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, that was the main standout to me. I said I don't feel that this is quite robust enough for me to run it myself, having not run anything else. I don't think it's a good entry level, but I think for people who are looking for a cool twist on the sort of OSR elegant rules light systems, I think it's has some fascinating twists. Curious to see how this develops over the coming year.
Very cool. Like, I think I'm honestly think that we should try a game of the month club. You know, like, you and I, there's a couple of people in our sphere who are into trying out new stuff, and these zine games are lightweight enough. We can, like I said, we can bring in the things we like from other game systems. I've got printed adventures and run them using a different system than what they were made for, because you should be able to adapt. If you have a solid enough rule set, you should be able to adapt any story into any other setting, system, I think we should honestly try a different game every month, and it shouldn't be that hard, especially if it's a different person. So you do it 1 month, I do it the next month, third person does it the month after that. It's not that hard to read a zine and cook up, you know, a couple of hours worth of gameplay.
And if it's designed as a one-shot, you don't have to get too invested in making sure it's perfect and setting up all of this, you know, lore and backstory and preparation. You just, like, it can be a little more slapdash, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And after 2 or 3 months, you got a wealth of experience under your belt, and you kind of know what you like and you know what you don't like.
Absolutely. Really cool. Let's try and workshop some ideas.
Yeah. So let's play Worm. Or Lutes, or another one of Hewlett's games. And there's plenty more zines I have printed back there, let me tell you. All right. I feel like that's a good amount. Maybe we'll have a shorter episode this time around. I know we have a bit of dessert. What do you think? Should we roll right into it?
Yeah, I mean, I could easily talk about several other video games I've been playing, but perhaps we'll have a slightly shorter episode. Last week was a little long. I am feeling the fatigue coming in after the drive up the coast today, so I think we might take it easy today.
Yeah, short is not a bad thing. All right. I'll go since you talked about a game last.
Go ahead.
I noticed while putting the notes together that you were talking about music, which some music potentially reviews or albums or whatnot. So I was inspired by that. I've been listening to a lot of new music because, as I've told people, I'm kind of getting into music again, which has been really, really nice for me, really nice for my kind of mental health. So I'm going to mention a couple albums if that works for you. So I might have returned these to the library already, so I don't have them to show you, but these were both provided to me graciously and freely. By the Vancouver Public Library System, so thank you to them. The first album I want to cover is by Beth Gibbons, who trip-hop fans will know is the lead singer of a band called Portishead. So Portishead was really big in the kind of early 2000s for being kind of a core group of the trip-hop scene, and a couple of fantastic albums and then a live album. So this is Beth Gibbons, and it's not her first solo album, but it's her latest, called Lives Outgrown, from 2024. And if you know Beth Gibbons at all from Portishead, you know that her voice is really kind of haunting and stirring and ethereal and kind of like a little trilly, soulful. It's really hard to describe, kind of like haunting. And those aspects carry over, those aspects work really well for trip hop, with kind of like grimy drum machine beats and kind of wailing and clanging of instruments and acoustic instruments and then like synthesizers or something like that. But this time around, her solo album is like folk and rock and roll. And it really, really works. Her voice works fantastic. The production is really like confident and mature. It's really cool, like, to hear her very unique voice. And then, like, there's a couple of songs where she brings in, like, a youth choir of, like, children's voices to sing some of the back up. And it's like, wow, like, this is, you just never expect that from this artist hearing her previous work. So I just think it's cool to hear an artist you're familiar with in a different genre. Are you a fan of Portishead, or have you listened to that band before?
I can't say I'm familiar with them at all, no.
Okay, it's cool stuff. I really enjoy it, and maybe it's just a sign of my age. Trip-hop stuff is very popular in the early 2000s. Okay, one more album, and this is also newer to me, by an artist called Joy Olodakun. And she is an American artist who I think family emigrated from Africa. So she grew up in the American South, African origin. She's a queer artist, and her music is similarly diverse. It's generally, you could probably call it somewhere between the spectrum of pop and country. The album I'm listening to, my first album I'm listening to her of hers is Proof of Life from 2023. But I think she's had 3 or 4 studio albums before this, so just new to me, I guess. It's really vibrant, really bright. There's like really interesting blends of instrumentation. There's like breakbeats in some of the music. There's like hip hop, like rap segments in some of the songs. And her voice, I don't know if this is going to be appealing for some, but she kind of like sounds like a young Justin Bieber. Like she has like a boy's voice, which is actually really endearing in a lot of her songs. And in terms of the general vibe of her material, I'd say it's kind of like a cross between like a Tracy Chapman and even a bit of Morcheeba, another late 90s popular band from my influences there. Her stuff, this album sounds like really, really contemporary, but also like really classic at the same time. So I just like really appreciate this artist, and I'm glad I took a chance. Just I knew nothing about her, found an album cover on a shelf, and I just picked it and I listened to it, and I'm really glad I did. So this is, you know, this is what you can do when you're just kind of browsing and got serendipity. So yeah, enjoying those two albums and much, much more.
Yeah, I can't say I have much point of reference for either of those artists or their respective genres. I mean, I do take pride in having a fairly eclectic taste, but I also just don't have a lot of time for music lately, to be honest, between podcasts and other media and being home a lot of the time. Especially right now, I can get away with listening to a podcast in one ear more often than I can just like tuning in, being fully immersed in an album. But this time of year, especially, I am more in a mood to check out some music, especially seeing sort of album of the year lists from the preceding year. And you having talked about music as well, I also had a couple in mind that I wanted to shout out. So looking through a couple of, you know, lists from reviewers that I enjoy. So part of the reason I don't talk about music much here in terms of in the dessert segment is that I have a pretty acquired taste, I will say, not to go full hipster, but I listen to a lot of pretty niche like prog and folk rock that's pretty off the beaten trail, that can be a little hard to recommend as an acquired taste. But a couple I've discovered recently that I think are a little more accessible, perhaps. One that I saw on a lot of lists from album of the year from last year, it's called Pachinko by a Norwegian prog rock band called Moron Police, described as a concept album about a guy who turns into a sentient pachinko machine in Tokyo. So as I said, pretty obscure there, but I just found this entire album a revelation, and just to very upbeat prog. Like I guess prog can get a bit of a bad rap as being quite pretentious and stale, but this is incredibly just vibrant and upbeat and eclectic and bombastic, and just, I mean, as you expect, covers like five different genres in the space of 10 minutes on one track. But I had a blast with this. It's I would recommend just go to listen to this 15 minutes of this Pachinko Part 1, Pachinko Part 2, two particular tracks. I think just give those a chance and see if it's your jam. But it's it'll take you on a trip. Like just hold on for those 15 minutes and you'll take a fun ride.
Let's think about recommendations, right? Because you can always make recommendations, whether people pick up on them or not, that's up to them. But yeah, it's kind of good to get recommendations out of left wing, because you know it's coming from a human rather than algorithm. So, or worse yet, from a publisher or something, a label or a magazine that, you know, makes money off of these recommendations. These are just things that delight us.
Yeah, one other thing I really noted was the artist for this band's albums are all by an artist called Dolk. This really odd sort of Hieronymus Bosch, like amalgamations of nature elements. There's a lot going on, but like that it feels quite relevant to prog and how eclectic that it can be. So that was a fun trip. One other quick recommendation. I haven't had a full chance to delve into this one fully yet, but one I've seen recommended a lot of, by friends is the Proto Men. Is this a band that you're familiar with at all, Mark?
No, I can't say I've listened to Proto Men, but I've heard the name bandied about.
Okay. Because it's like prog rock is one of my loves. My other love being rock operas. Often those two things are one and the same. But in this case, this is, I mean, not quite a cover band. They have done some cover albums, but it's a rock opera concept albums based around Mega Man, which isn't something I can speak to a lot personally. I've played a couple of Mega Man games, but I'm not like invested in that lore or anything. But music inspired by video games can often be a bit cheesy and just too much for me, to be honest. From what I've listened to so far, this definitely does not fit into that. That is to say, they just released a new album called Act 3, This City Made Us. It's the sort of third in this concept album series. I haven't listened to the first two yet, but this one was really strong. It came out just this year, but really strong. And it was interesting to see that like the main inspiration that came away to me, like a lot of 80s influences crossing a few different genres, but I couldn't help but think Meatloaf. Turns out they actually worked with the producer of Meatloaf, Alan Shacklock. So that comparison is, you know, I was right in the ball there apparently. But this a lot of like dark synthy rock that's a lot of fun. It sounds like driving down a dark road at night in the sort of the driving rain and all the feelings that evokes. So I'm enjoying that so far. Looking forward to digging into some of their older albums.
Yeah, very nice. You said that you had a hard time finding time to listen to music of late. And one thing that it might be an embarrassing admission, but I have taken to listening to music to go to sleep lately with earbuds. You know, this is not the truly wireless ones. These are like corded earbuds. They're not so deep that they're uncomfortable. And I am connecting them to my Hibby R1. And, you know, this could just be in my pocket. And this one has a convenient sleep timer feature. So I can set it, the sleep timer that just turns off in 30 minutes. So I can just like let it play and it soothes me to sleep, so long as the music selection isn't too raucous, I suppose. But I have it pretty quiet, so I'm finding that that's letting me get in another, you know, 20, 30 minutes of music appreciation in a day, which is like, you know, considerable when it's gone from like nothing to that. Like that's a decent dent.
Yeah, I've been through those phases, especially when my daughter was first born, and I was sort of trading off time, sleep time with my wife. And if I was sleeping alone, I could have some music on. Otherwise, I don't want to be bothering her. But it was definitely a small subset of music that I could be listening to. A lot of video game soundtracks actually fit the bill of that.
There you go. We all do what we can to enjoy our hobbies. All right, Daniel, what do you think? I feel like we covered a good selection there.
Yep, you've got a great mix today, nice and short, but that's what we're all about here, is a balanced diet of games and covering an eclectic mix of things that's surely to be something for everyone, I hope.
Yeah, that's right. These days, I'm realizing that balanced, I guess, like life and outlook requires kind of like a rebalancing of the things that you take in. You know, that can be everything from food to exercise to art and appreciation and relationships. So in terms of like art and the things that we can recommend, yeah, I'm really enjoying the discussions we're having about non-game stuff like reading, watching films and shows, and now music. Yeah, hopefully it's not too annoying for people, but we tend to mix it up. So hopefully there is something for everyone.
We go through trends. It comes in waves. But yeah,
we'll try and keep it balanced.
Trends right now.
Cool. All right, let's leave it there, Daniel. Anything else you want to shout out?
Quick plug. I mean, in terms of some of the games that I've been playing and haven't had time to talk about, I have been continuing to release a written review at least once a week so far. Just last week, I put out a review of the platforming puzzle game called Bionic Bay. A video game, that is. So far, you can find all of those on Backlogged. I'll put the link in the show notes. And I've got another one lined up for this coming week. So keep an eye on that. I'm hoping to just, again, practice my critical voice and try a different mode of talking about games, perhaps. A little more thought out way. So take a look there. Hoping to maybe find a blog option at some point in the near future. But that's it for now. Obviously, you can see us at Terminal City Tabletop Convention coming up in just a couple of months.
That's right, in March. Looking forward to that, and I got my tickets already, so we'll maybe see a few listeners there at TCTC.
Hopefully, yes. In the meantime, if you have any questions or comments on today's games or any music recommendations, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
Yep, and I'm on Blue Sky as MarkYuasa.bsky.social. And where can people find you, Dan?
Yep, you can find me at Board Game Feast, also at Blue Sky, and you can find the Omnigamers Club account there as well.
That's right. Go check out our episodes in video form on YouTube. Subscribe, like, and comment there. And if you want to listen to our older episodes, you can find them on audio form and a podcatcher of your choosing. We would love it if you would comment and share the show in any way you can with someone who you think would appreciate it.
Yes, always appreciated for anyone else joining the club. And remember to have a balanced diet of games. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.